I'm very pleased to welcome back to Fremantle Shipping News, David Wish-Wilson. Welcome back, David.
Thanks, Mike. Good to be here.
Well, it's lovely to see you again, particularly as I've just finished reading your latest book about to come out, a bit of a crime thriller, O'Keefe. Congratulations.
Thank you. Yeah, it's not far off now.
Well, last time we got together, it was to talk about The Sawdust House, a book which I really loved, I have to tell you. I love this one too, but I'm still dreaming about The Sawdust House. You were able to go, in a sense, between genres.
Yeah, I mean, I write primarily crime fiction, but it's nice to take a break every now and then from the quand of forward-moving, linear, spare prose that I associate with at least my crime writing, and spend time, in the case of The Sawdust House, in the, you know, in the 19th century, that beautiful, when English wasn't really standard yet. I mean, it still isn't super standard today, but so that was a really nice, I really enjoyed writing The Sawdust House, and you can probably tell. Yeah, different in structure, different in language and style, and for that reason it was a nice kind of break.
Which followed on, of course, from a book called The Cove, I think.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
It was a lovely, in that sense, a linear movement.
Yeah.
But O'Keefe follows on from a book called Cutler.
That's right, yeah. I mean, Cutler came out last year, and I thought it was probably going to be a one-off novel. I wanted to write about industrial fishing, and the original idea was to write a non-fiction book. And yet when I wrote Cutler, I had to invent a fictional character to tell that story, the story of industrial fishing and environmental crimes, I suppose you'd say. And I realised, I was intrigued by the idea of an undercover character or a chameleon-like character, a character who can be different in many different circumstances, but also one who doesn't have a kind of stable identity underneath. So he hasn't got anything to go back to, like a normal covert operative. He can't go back to a family life. And so it's like he needs that. He needs to be playing a role all the time. So with O'Keefe, he's offered another opportunity to go undercover within a criminal organisation, and because he needs to, he jumps at the chance.
It's really interesting, that character, the concept that there are or might be people like him, Cutler or O'Keefe, out there, and perhaps we can come back to that. The whole question of industrial illegal fishing, when you hear people talking about it in a totally non-fiction academic way, as I can remember doing a few years ago with a lawyer, academic lawyer who worked hard in that field. Mm. It's terrible. People are slaves.
Yeah, yeah. It's not as well known as it should be, but there are literally hundreds and hundreds of thousands of men, and they are primarily men, working effectively as slaves. If you ask the average person in the street, when did slavery end? They would might say, you know, the 19th century, and yet. All around the world, I mean, there are kind of economic slaves on land, but out in the open ocean, these men are particularly vulnerable because they have no recourse. It's a dangerous world, and if you complain or argue with the captain, you can be just killed and thrown overboard, which does happen. So some of these men, there's one poor fellow recently escaped and returned to Cambodia. He'd been a slave at sea for 23 years, and he'd escaped several times before, but each time the police caught him and took him back to the boats, because there was an arrangement between the fishing industry and the local policing in Indonesia. So pretty horrible stuff.
Well, this book, in the helpful blurb, or other writers have had the opportunity to say what they think. Chris Hammer, another well-known writer in this crime world, says, and I quote, "Vivid, dark, evocative, a hair-raising ride through Australia's criminal underworld," close the quote. And I agree entirely. I mean, you've got this real-life guy who's disappeared for 20-odd years and resurfaces, and you wonder, can any of this story in Cutler be true? And here we are in O'Keefe with all this stuff happening. Not only happening, David, but happening in the streets outside the window here in Fremantle, in the West End and all around,
yeah,
in the port.
That's right. I mean, as I live in Fremantle, this is happening in ports all around Australia, obviously. and all ports all around the world, really, but particularly in Europe and Australia. And so this is the port that I know best and love. You know, I love living near the port. And so I wanted to set the story here. It's a fictional story with fictional characters. However, it's something that is, like industrial fishing, it's something that is happening now. And I usually write historical crime novels. I explore different cultures of policing and organised crime going back 20 or 30 years. So Kabla and this are contemporary stories because things are changing very quickly.
Well, I think it's very interesting that you are doing this, because I'm reading through it actually saying to myself, I can't wait to meet David Wisniewski to discuss this, because what is he on about? Is he become a sort of a society critiquer? Is he wanting to tell us about how bad, obviously, he was, the illegal fishing trade is? And is he wanting to tell us about cocaine importation and the effect that it has in our community? Is that what crime writers do? Is that what you're doing?
Well, yes and no. I mean, crime writing should always, you know, the bottom line is that crime writing should always be entertaining. It's what readers expect, a certain degree of tension. But I've always been interested in social crime novels, I guess you'd call them. I can't see why you can't have your cake and eat it too, and provide, hopefully, an entertaining read while also exploring something contemporary and topical as well. And it just so happens that cocaine importation in Australia at the moment is a not often spoken about subject, but the way I see it has worrying, there are worrying features about it because of what's happened elsewhere in the world.
It's so easy living here in Fremantle, living in Australia, to be a little bit oblivious to the rest of the world, I suppose. I mean, you said ports here, ports everywhere. There are great importation places. They're the place you can bring things in. You can hide them in the sterns, the bars of boats. You can put them in all sorts of nefarious places. You can drop them off at sea and get people to collect them.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, and I explore all of those kinds of mechanisms. I guess the reason I think of this as a topical subject is because of the kind of concern in Europe in particular that, I mean, most people will know that certain countries like Belize and Colombia and to some extent Ecuador and Dominican Republic have become narco states, and Mexico on the border, in the border area there. This idea that drug money is so infiltrated every layer of government that it's to some extent destroyed civic society. And that's because cocaine is a pretty particular drug, and it's associated with enormous amounts of money in a way that, say, marijuana or opium or whatever isn't. And so this is a new thing for Australia. And the reason it's topical is that, in America, in North America, cocaine use has been prevalent for decades, right? And it's right next to the Mexican border. So the price apparently for a kilo of wholesale cocaine in America is $15,000, $20,000, right? So the next place that people looked, because that, you know, that's not a lot of profit for what it is, still some profit. The next place people looked was Europe. And so much cocaine has been imported into Europe that the price has fallen significantly. And it's down to, I think, about $40,000 or $50,000 dollars a kilo wholesale. When I started writing O'Keefe, the wholesale price, as I understand it, for cocaine in Australia was $280,000. So by the order of about, I don't know, 2,000% more than America, North America. So if you were a cocaine, if you're a cartel person, if you were a smuggler, if you're an organised crime figure, you'd be looking at a place like Australia and New Zealand. A, because we have per capita one of the highest rates of cocaine use. It's a very popular drug, and the prices are insane. I mean, I have my own opinions about prohibition. I do not envy, border force and the police trying to fight an unwinnable war against drugs. But what concerns me is that, as has happened in Central and South America, there's a concern in Europe that countries like Belgium and Holland and already parts of Galicia and the Balkans and Italy are increasingly becoming or showing all the traits of being narco-states, in the sense that they reckon that you know, quite a large proportion now of Dutch border force or customs agents are on the take, and that's because the money is so huge. In the old days with marijuana, you know, if you're importing marijuana, if you wanted a border force or a customs officer to turn away, you probably gave them $500. Now, if you're average person, they go, that's not worth it. I'll lose my job, I'll lose my reputation. But if you offer someone $100,000, well, that's a whole different thing. And that's the difference cocaine makes. It, the way it kind of, the money seeps through, it starts in the borders, it starts in the ports, and it ends up washing right through through society.
Now, all of that, if you like, as a plot, finds its way into O'Keefe. And towards the end of the book, you, in a couple of passages, had me reflecting on, yes, what's happening here? Is this a fight that can't be won? I remember when I was relatively young watching the movie Jesus Christ Superstar, and Tim Rice had a lyric in it, which had never really struck me philosophically before it was said. The Judas type character asked the Jesus type character about poverty, in a sense, what's he doing about it? And the Jesus character said to the Judas character, poverty's always been with us and always will be. I don't know why this shallow, perhaps deep philosophical thought hadn't occurred to me earlier, but poverty will always be with us. Not to say you shouldn't try to stop fighting it, but it struck me at the end of the book that you were saying that. This is there. In one sense, you can't get rid of it. What do you do about it? You've got an O'Keefe character whose only job is to go undercover again. You've got his handler who's you know, got his family. He's trying to live a life, and he lives in this dark world. Mm. I mean, is there any light at the end of this regulatory tunnel?
Well, no, I think not if our regulatory settings don't change. I mean, there are certain countries, you know, like Portugal, which haven't decriminalised drugs, but they've decriminalised possession. And as a result, drug use of the so-called hard drugs like cocaine and heroin has actually fallen rather than rising like it is in Australia. And so it is an unwinnable war. And like I say, I don't envy the border force or policing or customs. The only people that seems to me that win from our prohibition drugs model are people who get to talk tough on crime, largely politicians, and not many, very many of those, and organised crime figures. There's also not many of those, but that's where all the money's going. And there's an enormous, with for a drug like cocaine, the supply chain is just blood-soaked from beginning to end.
Well, there were passages in this book where I was thinking of No Country for Old Men or the Coen Brothers movie where people get killed and they just get plastered against a wall with a gunshot and it's spectacular in artistic terms. You know, post-impressionists couldn't sort of get the splatters better than that. And there are parts of your book, I have to say, have this startling, beautiful executions. You don't just kill someone. They go quickly, and you know, they hang from the rafters.
Yeah, well, I guess in O'Keefe, I'm trying to portray the violence as perfunctory almost, and banal, and that's because it is. I mean, organised crime. Most people think of organised crime, they think of the violence and whatnot, but it's a business. And I don't blame people for getting into organised crime either, because if the money is, if you can bring in a ton of cocaine and make $280 million, a lot of people are going to have a crack at that. So I don't necessarily blame people. And in that context, when the money is so, when the stakes are so high and the money that at risk is so enormous, killing people is just a sound business decision.
Yes, and it's what happens here. But you then need to hire the right people to work in your organisation. I mean, you've got some great named people in the book. I mean, O'Keefe on his own, Paul O'Keefe, previously Cutler. You've got Finn Dillon. I thought, gee, that's a great name. He's got a daughter called Skye. Madden, I think, is he the guy who'd been in the been in the forces. The
former SAS character.
Yeah, and so I mean, just a sort of a curious type question. How do you dream the names up? Do you go through? In the old days, you go through the telephone book. We don't have telephone books anymore.
Yeah, I like names. I wouldn't say I'm particularly good at choosing them, but I think about them more. And certainly with this Paul Cutler character, his only constant is that his first name is Paul. So while I'm writing this one, I'm thinking, if I go back to him, what might his next name be? You want a name that is ordinary, but somehow evocative. And so I like the phone book method, but for me, it's often just reading and listening, watching the television. If I hear a name, I think, oh, that's a good name.
Well, I love the Finn Dillon. For those old enough, I wasn't actually thinking of Matt Dillon, the fictional sheriff. But the Finn, all the Finns I know, have known in the world, are lovely, gentle people.
Same here.
And so I'm faced with Finn Dillon, and I'm thinking, oh, how lovely. And he's an acknowledged former outlaw motorcycle gang bikey talk person who's done some terrible things. But here he is. He's running a security firm down on the port, David. He's reformed, apparently.
Yeah, that's right. And that's where the plot kind of starts. So Paul O'Keefe is sent in to look for, there's a certain amount of cartel meth appearing on the streets, and O'Keefe's handler, who again is from the first book, Cutler, Malik Khalil, he sends Paul in undercover to try and find out where this meth is coming from, and then suddenly the operation, I suppose, is diverted from looking for meth to looking for cocaine, because there are shenanigans afoot. And again, these are fictional characters, and even fictional kind of modus operandi as well. You know, the rudder trunk is a famous one for smuggling. The dumping at sea, well, we've seen that here off the coast of Fremantle. This is happening all around Australia, and certainly all around Europe as well. It's a really easy way to do it. Finn Dillon is a kind of a reformed, former patched member of a bikie club, but again, this is where I'm kind of going with the novel. He may, in a different circumstance, continue to live quite a straight life, but suddenly the money, the opportunity to make as much money, is it's too great a temptation to ignore, and so he sets about trying to bring cocaine into Australia and corrupting, trying to corrupt all those around him as well. But again, it's a crime novel, so yeah, it's
a degree of, well, a latitude, artistic freedom and imagination. But the thing is, Dave, people will read this. I read this, and I'm now walking around the streets of Fremantle and wandering down the port for Fremantle Shipping News, feeling quite nervous. I see a big black ram four-wheel drive thing that's about 20 foot in the sky going past. I think, oh my God, who's that? Is that Finn Dillon?
Yeah, well, I mean, the thing about organised crime, I guess, is that, you know, when everything's working well, it's organised. There's no violence. There's no need for ordinary people like you and I to worry about it. But I guess, yeah, in this story, I'm exploring or beginning to hold out the picture of what the future might be like in 5 years, when our border force agents are corrupted and baggage handlers and when money's starting, real money, is starting to wash through the system. What effect does that have on our legal system, our journalism? I mean, Holland's most famous journalist famously was murdered, a few years ago because he was speaking about exactly this issue.
So it is, as all of the plaudits say from the readers so far, and me included, it really is gripping. It is a page turner. I didn't want to stop. I was reading it late at night. I wanted to know what was going to happen. And as you want in these, you want your reader to be guessing incorrectly about what's going to happen and how it's going to conclude.
Yeah.
And then, sort of interestingly, the points we've uncovered, you're looking at another issue in relation to the way our society works and the concept that this sort of drug importation is happening all the time, there is enforcement happening all the time, there are people undercover all the time, there are people running them all the time, and there are people trying to outwit them all the time, and it never ends. And you're showing this up at the same time without having to provide answers to it all, but I suppose that's what a good writer does.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think of a good crime novel as something that, you know, tells a story, entertains the reader, and maybe asks questions. And, you know, often the answers are not for me to give. They're for people to kind of wonder at. I have my own opinions about our prohibition model. And the long-standing war against drugs, so-called, and just the damage that has caused around the world to civil society everywhere, but particularly in Central and South America, North America to some extent, now parts of Europe. It's not a future that I think any liberal democracy wants to kind of countenance, but it can be changed with a few kind of policy settings. It's not an easy process because, you know, decriminalising drugs or whatever is going to create a harm as itself. However, it's about balancing the harm that's already happening against future harm, I suppose.
Well, when you take your book on the circuit, you'll be able to talk to the regulators as well as people who just love a gripping yarn, and you've managed, may I say, to do both, for me, very successfully, so congratulations. I think you've already intimated, maybe intentionally without quite realising it, that O'Keefe's going to come back. He's going to have another name, but he's going to have something else to do, I think.
Yeah, well, I guess I'm a little bit sentimental, but as has happened with every other character I've introduced, once I finish a story, I keep thinking about wondering how they're going, and it was a bit easier with my early Frank Swan novels. Well, he's still around because, he used to live in the same house as I do. He still
yes, goes, I believe.
He goes to Frank.
Yes.
I think there's still some legs with the Paul Cutler, Paul O'Keefe, and I haven't decided on a name for the next one yet. I'm still looking, scanning the horizon for an evocative name. I like this idea of... I've always been intrigued by the undercover character, the kind of the courage it takes for a policeman or woman to go into a situation to pretend to be someone they're not when the stakes are so high, you make a mistake, and it can literally mean your life. I admire it a great deal.
Well, I said at the outset, coming back to this guy, and you describe someone who, in a sense, doesn't have a place where they otherwise belong. You think there are people just like that, and how do they survive in an ordinary world?
Yeah, I'm not aware if there are covert operatives or undercover people who are like that, but I mean, what got me thinking about this kind of character is just, my dad's a Vietnam veteran, and so men of his generation and my grandparents' generation, What inspired me to think about this kind of character and his inability to function as an ordinary, stable, coherent identity was this idea of men going away to war and coming back different and having to put on a mask and trying to find a way to kind of fit in, and yet they're so altered that it becomes an impossible task, and some manage it better than others. My dad managed it very well, by and large. He's this kind of character. He's different in the sense that he didn't have a stable childhood, so he was moving from place to place. So he's used to adapting, trying to fit in, trying to be someone he's not. But what happens, when you completely lose the ground under you, and all you are is the mask. All you are is the, I think I describe him as an actor just moving from role to role, as you would, I suppose. So I think it's an intriguing thing to look at, and so I've found a new situation to put him in and see how he goes. Yeah.
And the Madden character, of course, seems to have found his way of surviving, having been an SAS operative.
Yeah, he is based on characters I've met over the years.
Mm.
You know, quite a damaged man in many respects. Very cynical, nihilistic even.
Mm.
Life, there is no meaning in things beyond, the kind of reality you create for yourself, I guess. So he's someone, I guess, who, because of his experiences, sees the facades, the necessary facades that make civil society function. He sees them all as props on a stage, I suppose. And so he's just chosen to live, ignoring all of those things, live his own kind of way. Really, he just wants a simple life. But again, he's found himself in a situation where suddenly he's gone from potentially working a minimum wage security job to earning a decent coin, amount of income. And so he's beguiled by that, as most people would be.
I imagine every criminal lawyer in Perth will be wanting to know from you, David, whether you've fashioned Sky Dillon on them, man or woman.
Well, no, I'm pretty careful these days, having copped a bit of stick from in with the earlier Frank Swan novels. This is very much a work of fiction. I mean, I've been quite careful about that. So none of the characters, Finn Dillon, Sky Dillon, Cutler, Madden, they're not based on any real people, or even, the security company that Finn Dillon has started is not based on any kind of real company as well.
Now, David, you teach as well. You're busy at Curtin University. You write prolifically. How do you balance it all, and have you got another one in the pipeline?
Yeah, I balance it, I think, by being a little bit mad. And for me, I think it's... because my life is quite busy, I feel like I need writing more. For me, it's, it's obviously it's work. It's sometimes hard work, but it's my recreation as well. I mean, I enjoy doing it, otherwise I wouldn't do it. So when life gets stressful, like it does for everyone else, some people want to go for a run, some people want to drink 10 pints of beer, I want to write. And so for me, writing is a respite. It's like sleep. And so I try and find as much time as I can. I'm lucky in that my job at Curtin, I get one day a week as my research time. And then I kind of work around the edges of that before work, late at night. There is another Lee Southern novel coming out late next year. That's set in 1999, so he's slowly moving towards the present. It's only 25 years old. But I mean, I'm exploring that kind of weird anxiety around the expected or anticipated collapse of the worldwide computer system on New Year's Eve 1999, set inside a West Australian prison. So it's a weird scenario, but that was fun to write too.
Well, David Wish Wilson, thank you for joining me this morning here in the West End of Fremantle, where nefarious things happen, particularly in this latest novel of yours. O'Keefe, congratulations. It's a great read, and I'm sure all our listeners will agree with me once they've got their hands on it rather shortly.
Thanks, Michael, and thanks for having me along again.